Hello and welcome to Breakfast All Day.
Hello.
Hopefully you can see and hear us, depending on whatever platform it is you are enjoying us upon.
If you're just hearing us, that's great too.
We are here in some form. We exist. I'm Christy.
I'm Alonzo.
I'm Matt.
And boy, is it ever super January this week. It's bad.
Yeah.
I didn't see the big movie of the week yet, so I can't opine, but y'all will be telling us all about it. But yeah, it seems like the kind of movie that would be a hit in January.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's Glass. We'll talk about Glass eventually. We're playing catch up with Replicas because it's so terrible that it must be seen. We got a couple of competing documentaries about the Fyre Festival. And I watched a television show.
Woo!
That was not Bob's Burgers or Futurama. It was the first episode of the new season of True Detective.
Wait, the first two episodes?
Oh, well, I only watched one. Wait, were there two?
Yes. What was it? Two, yeah. It was two hours of TV.
Oh, shoot. I watched episode one.
Well, I guess we'll talk about episode one.
Okay.
Are they going to show two every Sunday?
No, that was just to get things rolling.
Damn it.
All right, we'll do two and three next week.
I can't even do that right. I can't even watch television correctly.
Math is hard.
All right, so let's start with Glass. This is the long-awaited, if you're M. Night Shyamalan, follow-up to Unbreakable and Split. 19 years after Unbreakable came out, 2 years after Split, we now have Glass, which ties the whole thing up. Matt, please tell us about it.
So Glass starts off with somebody called the Overseer, who we know as David Dunn, played by Bruce Willis, as we saw from Unbreakable, on the trail of the Horde, played by James McAvoy and James McAvoy and James McAvoy and James McAvoy, a character who has multiple personalities, one of which is, you know, a minor version of the Hulk. And then they both get locked up, and maybe they're all just imagining things, and they're in the same place that Mr. Glass is. And maybe he's insane, too. Maybe they're all insane. Maybe they're not. Who knows?
Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah.
His real name is Elijah
Wood.
It's not. Cummings. Oh. Elijah something, but he goes by the name Mr. Glass because he has this thing with his bones, which makes him very brittle.
Yes. Anyway.
I did just finally watch Unbreakable in the last couple of days.
It holds up pretty well, I think.
It's okay, yeah. And it had a twist I didn't see coming.
Right.
Well played, M. Night.
Right.
He was dead the whole time.
But now I have to watch Split before I go see Glass, which I have to watch for who shy is.
Do you want to cover up your ears while we talk about this?
Whatever. I don't care.
So this is such a letdown. I really liked Split, and a lot of what makes Split fun is this big, showy performance from James McAvoy. And each of the characters, each of the personalities competing for a time in the light is really distinct and really well drawn, and he gives it his all. It's really showy and scenery chewing. And the cool thing with Split is that M. Night Shyamalan really leans into his Hitchcock worship in the best ways.
Right.
Like, the camera work is like gorgeous, dazzling, virtuoso camera work, like beautiful, long, fluid, elegant takes. And that's what's cool about Split. And then there's a twist at the end of Split, which connects with Unbreakable. And here we are now at Glass.
Well, and really, it's more of an Easter egg at the end of Split,
right?
Like, it's more of an Easter egg than anything else. That's like, oh, look, that's in the same shared universe. Like, okay, that's fine. But you take that out of the movie, and the movie still functions really well. It's this great, you know, scenery-chewing performance by McAvoy, but it's awesome, right? He's doing a, you know, at least seven or eight distinct characters within the movie that you get to know, and you can see just in his body language which one is which, and he's having fun with it, and you're kind of having fun with him, and it's this kind of lurid thriller, and it works really well.
And then you have Glass.
And it's like that character was brought in from a totally different filmmaking paradigm than what we go back to, because Unbreakable is this kind of quiet, you know, languid, you know, I don't even necessarily want to say thriller so much as it's a kind of mystery, and it takes its time and it's good. But the character from Glass, like, oh my God, what is he doing in this movie? And granted, as this movie takes off, the first two thirds of it, I was kind of going along with it. Like, okay, this is kind of interesting. This is, you know, it's a decent look at what would happen with people like this in a real world setting. And it stays relatively grounded. And
because they all have these abilities, right? They believe they're superheroes in their own ways. And they're all locked up together in the same psychiatric institute where Sarah Paulson is overseeing them and studying them and more, as we eventually learn.
Right.
But they all feel really disparate still, all three of them.
They feel very separate. But again, you know, I found myself like, yeah, you know what? Somebody might lock these guys up and start treating them like they were crazy and maybe get the, you know. And it, again, it felt relatively grounded. And then it just really disappointingly fell apart at the end. And I really was sad about that, because I actually thought if a different ending in this could have made for something really interesting. But once, you know, once you get about halfway through the point where Glass and the Horde are working together, it just gets loony. And it, like, it almost gets back into being a movie about the James McAvoy character. Like, it's, I guess it's, what I'm saying is there's these tonal shifts in it that by the end, it just, like, gloves are off, it's going crazy. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute, I'm going to drop in 70, you know, or 17, 18 pages from a different script and just put them in here. It feels completely different, and it doesn't really work.
It's loony, but it's also really self-serious, and there's a ton of hand-holding as far as walking us through in really ponderous, self-serious ways, like the mythology he's created and the real-life comic book that he's brought to life here. And it's never as profound as he clearly thinks it is. Right.
Well, and this is just a question from having put through the review on the wrap. The movie apparently sort of handles comic books as though they were as niche now as they were in 2000, which
the
world has changed greatly.
I mean, characters feel like they need to explain the tropes, right? Explain, like, here's what a villain does, here's what this person would do now, you know, again, walking us through the standards of just comic book storytelling or whatever in a way that's not new or fresh. It has no commentary.
And really unnecessary, because you get that you get so much of that in Unbreakable, which works. It works in that. But by the time you're here, like, you don't still need Glass or his mother telling you why things happen.
Mm-hmm. Like, or why they matter.
Like, it doesn't matter. I mean, yeah, okay, obviously he's the genius supervillain. We saw the other two movies. That's why we're here.
I feel like they're all in different movies. For a big chunk of Samuel L. Jackson's time on camera, he is in a vegetative state, we think. It appears. He is in a wheelchair in this institution. He doesn't speak. He has an eye twitch here or there. It feels like a total waste of what we know Samuel L. Jackson can do. You know, he's a massively verbal performer. Right. He uses that as one of his intimidating strengths. It can be funny, or it can be exciting. He's just mute here for a long time. Bruce Willis may as well be mute, because he's like asleep practically. Yeah. There's just nothing. And maybe it's brooding or it's torment because he has this psychic ability to, like, brush up against somebody and sense who they truly are and what they're truly up to. Maybe that's taking a toll on him, and that's why he's so introverted and sad. But, like, it's never engaging at all. And then on the totally opposite end of the spectrum is James McAvoy, all the variables of James McAvoy, which, again, it's an actor's showcase, and he's really good at shifting from one to another within a single breath even. But gosh, a little bit of that goes a long way. And there's a trick they do with, like, a strobe light, which forces him to, like, snap from one character to the next, to the next, to the next. And, like, doing it once is not enough. They do it over and over and over again. It's like, yes, Knight, we get it. This is a cool trick that you're pulling off.
Well, watching Unbreakable, you know, just even those opening moments when they're on the train, I was like, oh yeah, this is like when Bruce Willis still gave a shit. And, like, I'm wondering, is that Bruce Willis showing up to play here, or is it the one in the last decade or so?
No, it's mailing it in Bruce Willis.
Right, it's mailing it in, who's like, oh, I was laconic in this movie, then no one will notice.
It's also a total waste of Anya Taylor-Joy. So Anya Taylor-Joy is in Split. Yeah. She is one of the young women that Kevin and the Horde abduct in Split, and she forms a connection with him, and she comes back here. And she's such an interesting performer, like, just her presence and her eyes, and she can do a wide variety of stuff and doesn't get a whole lot to play here. Sarah Paulson is always good. is a really lengthy M. Night Shyamalan cameo here, like longer than most.
Does it make sense that the woman who was abducted by James McAvoy in the first movie is now so concerned with his welfare?
Yes.
From a Stockholm Syndrome kind of perspective, perhaps. They have a connection they forge.
There's a connection that, I mean, part of it is there's a connection that we see in Split. Mm-hmm. And so that gets played again here.
I see.
Let's talk really fast because I've had several folks on Twitter mention to me that this is a concern of theirs, is like, how does this film depict this mental illness that McAvoy's character has? And that was a concern when Split came out too, the notion that it was exploiting for cheap thrills and depicting as a villainous force somebody who suffers from dissociative identity disorder. Matt.
That's, you know...
is that a concern?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would, you know, not knowing enough about how, you know, the particulars of it, you know, if it's that, you know, sort of the traditional, I mean, not way, way back, but, you know, the more, I think more recently we realized that those identities get created as survival mechanisms. So it's true to that, but...
Because he has trauma that he's trying to heal from.
Right. But I think it does still, I mean, look, like, you know, it's a guy climbing on walls, right? So it's, I think it does use it. And then when it starts, because it tilts into, you know, there's, and we know this from Split, half those characters, half of those personalities are worshiping the Horde. And I don't...
They are the Horde, right?
Well,
you mean the Beast.
The Beast, sorry. They're worshiping the Beast.
Yes.
And I don't, I've never really gotten the sense that personalities in someone like that are worshiping another one and being like almost trying to, you know, at some point the one kind of leader female one, I can't remember her name.
Patricia,
like is serving as his prophet almost, mm-hmm. right? As the Beast's prophet. And I don't, so at that point, like you're not seeing like, well, how is Patricia a survival mechanism? Right.
And she keeps things in order.
Well, okay.
I'm guessing.
Right,
I don't know.
But I think that, yeah, you know what? It probably is. I mean, look, using that as the villain character, I mean, at, you know, Occam's Razor. Yeah, it is going to be exploitive.
Isn't that true in any horror movie, though, with a serial killer? He's there for cheap thrills. I don't know.
I don't know that we feel sorry for serial killers, though, do we?
Or I meant to feel sorry for James McAvoy? Maybe.
For Kevin.
For what he endured.
Yeah, but, you know, again, like, is this... Yeah, I mean, look, like, I don't know... You know, again, I don't know enough, and I'm not someone who has that issue, so I'm not really... I don't really have the standing to say something, but I, you know, I'm not going to, you know, if somebody's saying, oh, I think that's exploiting, I'm not going to argue with them. Yeah. Like,
no, it's right, tricky. Like, it's a topic that's out there. So I wanted to bring it up. There's no answer for us to come up with, but it's something that people have asked, hey, will you guys mention it?
So. I mean, it does, you know, I will say like, you know, this movie doesn't paint genius supervillains in a particularly good light, but you know.
Anyway, this movie's just a bummer. It's just, it's disappointing. Split was really good. M. Night is so wildly hit and miss, you know, either his work is thrilling and exciting and inspiring or it's just crap.
Here's the thing. M. Night's great when he's working small, and with Unbreakable, he's still working small, right? He's got these, he's still feisty. He's still got something to say and it hasn't all gone to his head yet. But after, by the time he gets past Unbreakable, like, that's where you start, you know, like Signs. You're like, ooh, this is getting...
Oh, I didn't hate Signs.
I didn't hate Signs, but... But it gets worse from there. Partly because, you know, the signs are there in that he casts himself in a relatively important role in that movie. And that's a movie that by the time you get to the twist and when you realize how Signs ends... And the more you think about it, the more it falls apart in a way that Unbreakable and Sixth Sense do not. Mm-hmm. Right. And then you get to like Lady in the Water and
the
like,
Village,
oh my God,
and the Happening,
and the thing
Last Airbender.
Right. And so, you know, when he has these big budgets, he goes crazy. But when he's, and this is a thing where I think this is a movie that everybody's clamoring for him to do. When he comes in and he sneaks up on you, he's great. Right. And I think that this is a movie. It's like, oh, when expectations are good, right. I think he cracks. I think the pressure gets to him and he takes these big swings that he thinks people want him to take and they don't go well. Split comes along. No one's expecting anything out of him, yeah. Right? Split is otherwise, cause it's not like there's some big twist at the end of Split. Split is like, oh, yeah, dude can make a serviceable horror movie, right? Same thing with The Visit, right? Like, oh, hey, right, he can do these little movies. And I mean, not little, but he can do these more smaller scale, intimate movies, and they work. And the minute he starts going more than like 8 or 9 characters, you're like, oh, God, stop, right?
All right, so what is your number then? You said 6.
I said 6. That's probably right. A little high, but it's...
Do you want to change your 6?
No. I mean, it's not a... I don't think it's a total loss. It's just it ends badly. Like, I'm kind of along for the ride, and then it just... Not just the twist that he gives us, and look...
It is a twist.
People are going to complain, like, it's M. Night Shyamalan. Right. If you don't go in expecting a twist, come on. But... Even just the end of the regular story, it's like, oh, come on.
Yeah, what it ends up being is not nearly as profound as he clearly thinks it is.
Right.
All right, so I'm saying 4. So our number's a 5. It's 36% on the tomato meter.
Yeah, I mean, if you're excited to go see all three of these characters get together, like, you're not going to necessarily be disappointed, but God, he could have done something really, really cool here, and he just, I feel like he drops the ball at the end.
I think there are some theaters that are showing all three of them back to back to back.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of night. It's a long day's journey into night.
Whoa! Oh! You know, the problem is his movies are so slow, especially the first one and this last one. It will feel like watching all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies in one sitting.
All right, so don't go see Glass. So we played a little bit of catch-up. Actually, I made Alonzo play catch-up.
She tried to make me do it, but I was having none of it.
Right. Well, you missed out on a good time at the movies. Also, Matt forgot. But I had to go see Replicas for radio.
Then I had to go see Replicas.
I could not experience this alone. Somebody else had to like vouch for how insane it is.
I was going to see it, but I had the luxury of sending my replica.
Boo. All right. So, Alonzo, please try and describe this batshit crazy twist.
Okay. So,
plot.
Keanu Reeves is a scientist. we're just going to start there.
Okay. Hang on. Let's be clear. This is not the first time that that's happened. Do you remember the
cold?
He wasn't a scientist. He was a courier. Do you remember the movie? What was it? The Cold Fusion movie with him and Rachel Weisz, where they're escaping the nuclear blast on the motorcycle.
Oh, right.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't remember the name of that movie, but somebody will tell me.
It did make me think of Johnny Mnemonic a lot, because it's all about brain stuff. And he is trying to figure out a way to basically download the memories and brain activity of recently deceased people into a computer and then putting all of that into a robot. And every time he does it, the robots kill themselves because they freak out about being robots.
Who wouldn't? You know, you wake up and you're a robot.
Exactly.
I don't know. It depends on the robot. It might be awesome.
What are you going to do? So anyway, he is off. This is all happening in Puerto Rico, and which has apparently been untouched by Hurricane Maria.
It's pre-hurricane Puerto Rico. Pre-paper towel Puerto Rico.
I guess so. Anyway, so then there's a terrible car accident, and his wife and 3 children are killed. And so, of course, he decides he's going to save their brains and then put them into clones that his buddy Thomas Middleditch is going to help him create. And
so why did they not call this the man with 3 brains? Because that would be awesome.
In his briefcase.
Here's the most important thing. Did someone, because if not, I'm going to write this in a movie about replicants. Did someone crib the line from Once Upon a Time in Mexico? And does somebody ask one of the robots, are you a replican or a replicant?
Oh, I get it. No. Nothing that clever ever occurs in this movie.
So here's a movie that deals with all these sort of like, you know, moral dilemmas and ethical questions, to which the movie kind of responds with an
never.
Just like life.
No one cares. No one questions anything.
At any point in time does anybody behave like an actual human being would in a moment of crisis.
Are you saying
right?
that they behave like...
Robots. Okay. Yes. No, stop. Because so Thomas Middleditch
shows up.
Sorry,
I didn't see this movie. I just want to riff on how
it's basically it is an expensive version of the brain that wouldn't die in a lot of ways.
So there's so much wrong with this, and yet it gets so nutty. It's so insane, like twist after twist and decision after decision, getting deeper and deeper.
Alice Eve, whose clone manages to have the exact same hairstyle that the human version has.
Listen, Alice Eve, who came in and talked to a couple of us.
Oh, that's right.
Oh my God, she's a baby.
She's a babe. She is.
She's a surgeon in this one.
Right, and that actually becomes relevant.
I'd let her operate on me.
So,
that's right. Yes, it does.
Keanu Reeves's car goes like off a cliff in a storm, and that's how they all die, yeah. Right? Except for him. He walks away unscratched. And he calls Thomas Middleditch, who was like his right-hand man at the cryatorium, whatever the hell this place is, where they're working on this stuff.
Hinky Genetic Lab, Inc.
It's called something incredibly generic like that.
Oh, my God. This is getting so good.
Bio 9.
And so he calls him. And, like, wouldn't you freak out if you saw, like, your buddy's entire family laid out dead, like, in a perfect row on the edge of the water in the pouring rain? Like, you would panic. You would react in some way in a really intense manner. And he's just like, wow, what happened? it's really strange. It never at any point in time did anyone react to
Thomas Middleditch has my favorite terrible line in this movie, which is like, something terrible could go wrong.
So he also, many terrible things already have gone wrong. So he agrees to steal like many millions of dollars worth of scientific equipment.
Which no one misses because it's all going into Keanu's basement.
Right. So he like rolls it out and rolls it into a van, and like Keanu creates this whole makeshift lab, like Frankenstein lab situation.
There's not enough pods to make the whole family.
Oh, yeah.
So not only does he have to like Sophie's choice which one doesn't get brought back, he then goes into everybody's brain programs and erases all memory of the other
of the
kid.
Person who
this movie makes now, no okay. sense
so many
whatsoever.
Questions
so many things come to mind, like first of all, it makes me think based on that and all this other times we've seen people steal equipment in movies, scientific equipment, like there's a great sketch to be made about somebody who teaches villains how to quickly carry and swipe like scientific equipment.
It looks
right?
heavy. Oh, actually there is one useful tidbit is that he goes around to all the cars and all his street and steals all the car batteries
because
to like
a backup generator. Because if the power goes out on the pods, then the clones will be.
They can't. It's also kind of like speed. Like they can't get below a certain temperature or number, or they're all going to die. It's like speed, but they're pods.
So here's the thing: does the movie answer like okay? So his whole family goes like, does he need to take all the bodies back? Like you would
yes.
just need.
Oh, no. He tells Thomas Middleditch like, to get rid of the bodies.
Oh, right.
Because
right,
he can't do it.
But,
he grows new ones.
Right, but I'm saying, do you need to take the bodies back to the lab? Can't you just take the heads?
That's what he does.
He's not doing anything with their bodies. He's growing clones
right,
of everybody
okay.
to then put the computer brain stuff back into.
But he takes the brain goo. He takes the brain goo from the people.
It's not goo.
Whatever it is.
I don't know what's happening.
It's their genetic material.
But
he takes the brain goo.
It's all saved on these big external disks.
Drives, like big hard drives. And then he can put one into each person.
Here's the thing, though. This movie is not nearly as fun as I'm describing it.
It's not.
Like, it is more fun to have seen it than it is to watch it. Because it is so... It never revs up any kind of stakes. Like, he's doing this, like, bananas stuff. He's tampering in God's domain, as they like to say in old sci-fi movies. And with, like, no one cares. It's not bugging him at all. And the movie ultimately sort of decides, like, you know, what if we did Frankenstein but with a happy ending?
Yeah.
You know, and spoiler.
Or is it a happy ending?
It's bananas.
Or is it? Okay, there are many funny things that happen in here. One of them is that John...
the mapping. Sequence.
Yeah, so Keanu being Keanu makes a lot of this really enjoyable because he'll begin the neural mapping sequence. Do you concur? I concur. There's just weird conversations that happen. John Ortiz is his boss,
yes.
who is just like an asshole over and over again, and is just you know, on his case, and where's the equipment, and where's the robot you promised me that was going to be operational?
Yeah,
and
the board is going to shut you down.
It will shock you to learn that perhaps these robots with human brains are not being created for the most, you know, ethical purposes. It might shock you to learn that. Yeah, I don't know why they're in Puerto Rico.
Because they're working Jurassic Park.
There's one, you know what? There's one interesting thread here that they pick up and then they just drop, which is that Keanu Reeves has a couple of teenagers. And
I wouldn't bring them back.
Their friends.
Oh, right.
All are looking for them, like either in their video games or interactive video games or on text or on their phones. They're like, dude, where are you? Like, where are you? You know, your man's messing around with somebody else. And so he goes on to all the various devices.
And like he has to respond to
the laptops and the phones. He has to pretend to be his own children. And like, he learns things about his kids that he didn't want to know. And like, that's interesting. And then they just completely abandon that notion.
Yeah.
Also, his wife has, he has to pretend to be his wife. He sends an email as his dead wife, pretending to be her, explaining why she hasn't been at work lately.
Couldn't he just have...
That's an interesting idea.
Couldn't he just created, like, bots online based on his teenagers? That would have been a lot easier, right?
In this movie, it would have been plausible. But, this movie just sort of, like... It literally just sort of digs itself into these really bizarre quandaries and then is not interested in how they are resolved. Mm. It's like, yeah, whatever.
Keanu, as much as I enjoy Keanu so much, and there's a new John Wick 3 trailer, which everyone's very exciting. We'll talk about that eventually when the movie comes out. I really like Keanu, but he's like almost too sedate for this. You need increasingly insane, like Nicolas Cage levels of crazy to pull this off and make it as campy as it like.
He is the chillest mad scientist ever.
Somewhere underneath here is a really insane and very self-aware kind of sci-fi action thriller, and it never gets to that level.
Let's remake this with John Mulaney.
That'd be fun. That'd be really fun.
So this is from my favorite company, Entertainment Studios Motion Pictures.
It's a real thing.
Which sounds like a, some sort of, you know, Russian shell company in the Antilles. But no, it's a real company. It's Byron Allen's company. And there's a teaser for the 47 Meters Down sequel. So,
which is not called 48 Meters Down.
No.
It's called 47 Meters Down Uncaged.
It was sitting right there. Come on.
So this is bad, but almost not bad enough. So I'm saying 3.2.
I said 2. It's boring, frankly, I was led to believe it would be funnier.
It's nutty.
Not just from you. Other people
I was told
said
it would be
funnier.
Cake.
Yes.
Exactly. It was not pension pie.
Will you agree that it's nutty, though? It is insane.
Oh, it's nutty, but it's just dull.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so our numbers are 2.6. Is it 8?
Woo!
It's in single digits on the tomato meter. It's at an 8. So there is like a person who took pity on it and enjoyed it. So anyway, replicas. We played catch up with it for you.
You're welcome.
So there are a couple of different Fire Festival documentaries that came out. The Fire Festival, in case you guys don't remember, is this infamously notorious failure. It was this music festival. It's supposed to have been like the next Coachella, the next Burning Man.
But Coachella for like super rich people.
Right.
Millennials.
They got all these like social media influencers like Kendall Jenner to really promote it. And it was all going to be like supermodels and hot bands on Pablo Escobar's island and, you know, luxury tents. And it wound up being a total disaster.
A fiasco. Right. And so
anyone watching at home, I'm watching what my dog is doing as she's trying to go under the table.
He's watching what his dog is doing. So,
by my dog, I mean
my dog. So there are two different documentaries that happened to come out within a few days of each other. There was already this Netflix one that was scheduled to come out on this Friday, January 18th. And then Hulu just like came in a few days early and just said, nope, we've got one too. We're going to put ours out first. So Hulu kind of scooped Netflix on that. The Hulu one is called Fire Fraud. And the Netflix one is called Fire, The Greatest Party That Never Happened. And they cover a lot of the same ground. They have very different tones.
Yeah.
And they have different squishy ethical issues.
Yes.
Right. So the Hulu one is a little lighter and a little more playful and kind of...
It's a little more sticking it to millennials.
It plays the blame a lot more on just like the notion of FOMO, like, you know, and how influential a single Instagram image can be, even if it's just like an image of an orange screen. Like they made this thing go viral, the Fyre Festival people, with like just an orange screen. And what does it mean? And ooh, how do I get in on the orange screen and all that?
And then you click on the ad, which the ad, of course, was far better produced than the actual festival. So
right. Yeah. The actual festival ended up being like the photo shoot they did for the ad. And then we should take a step back and say that the festival itself was never meant to be just a festival. It was meant to like help launch this app, this Fyre app, which was like Tinder for musical acts.
Yeah, like basically Uber for celebrities, where if you wanted Ja Rule, who is one of the parties responsible, to play at your birthday party, this would be a way that you could book him easily through this Fyre app.
Right, you put a bid or what, I don't know how it works, but anyway, that was what this was meant to have been, and this is meant to be the launching pad for that. So the Hulu movie is a little lighter and a little more playful in tone, and the Hulu movie has an interview with Billy McFarland, who is the tech entrepreneur, mastermind, con man behind all of this, who is currently serving 6 years in prison for fraud.
Yes.
Not even for this, for a whole other con that he had the balls to try to pull off while he was on bail. That
nice.
Is chutzpah. So he was young and
he ran for president?
Pretty much. He was young and charismatic and schmoozy. And
they do talk about how the age of Trump figures into this, both in people needing an escape and wanting to believe in this fantasy, and also this sort of like the age of chicanery that we're living in.
Right. Like, it's like people just kept forgiving him over and over again. And so they have Billy McFarland because they paid for an interview with Billy McFarland, and it's kind of fun to watch him squirm awkwardly, but it's not terribly forthcoming. He won't really answer anything.
True, but weirdly enough, I think Fyre Fraud does a better job at digging into his sort of history of scumbaggery.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they really go in a lot more on, he had this previous thing called Magnesis that was this like, you know, it was like a black card for people who use their debit card, basically. And it was like this total house of cards and this long con.
It's all a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything he's done has been a Ponzi scheme.
He's robbing the next guy to pay for the last guy.
I mean, this is not all venture capitalists, but there are some venture capitalists out there that's that whole thing that works. Like, and entrepreneurs that they'll sell you and they'll tell you anything to get the money. It's like, oh, wait, it all crashed out. Bye-bye.
So anyway, but I think the Netflix movie, even though it did pay, or sorry, the Hulu movie, one, even though they did pay McFarland to be in it, I think is harder on McFarland and goes deeper into, you know, all the stuff with his mother, the testimony that she gave in his trial about how, oh, he was always so advanced. And,
right. Yeah.
So I think that in that regard, even though they did pay him, they do a better job of exposing him. And then you've got the Netflix doc, which is co-produced by the people who did the social media for the Fyre Festival, which you can look at as either an insider point of view or an agenda point of view, which the Hulu one would certainly suggest. They talked to somebody who used to work at that agency. I think that in the same way that there were two J.T. Leroy documentaries, there was The Cult of J.T. Leroy and J.T. Leroy Writer, and the latter one actually had the participation of Laura Albert, the woman who pretended to be J.T. Leroy. And so you get all of these like phone messages and a lot of insider stuff, but you also get her version of the facts, which is, you know, questionable at best. And then Cult of, I think, because it's from the outside, it takes a harder look at the whole J.T. Leroy phenomenon. And so together, I think those movies tell you a complete story. And I think together, these two Fyre Fest films really give you a fuller story, because like the Netflix one has the story about the guy who they actually asked him to go blow a customs official to get the Evian water through
out of customs, right?
And I was just like,
there's a lot of crazy stories.
My jaw was on the floor.
Yeah. So yeah, each of them is trying to take the moral high road here. Like, you know, the Netflix folks are saying, we wouldn't pay Billy.
Right.
Billy's ruined enough lives already. Why should we support him? Right. But then they have the Jerry Media people who did the social media. I don't think the Netflix movie goes easy on them, though. It does not absolve them from their crucial role in creating hype for this thing, which then defrauded all these people.
But the Hulu movie, the guy who used to work at Jerry outright says, within a couple of weeks of the event, they knew it wasn't going to happen. They knew this was a disaster, and they kept selling the idea.
The momentum had gone so far.
Right. Which the Netflix film doesn't say. So who knows what the truth is, but I think both of these angles are interesting. And if you're interested in the story, these movies are different enough and have different enough little sort of sub-anecdotes mm-hmm. that you'll enjoy watching both.
Yeah. There's like one guy who is in both.
Yes.
Who has a Twitter account, but then also has a fake Twitter account of like a fake, you know, millennial social influencer guy. Is he the one who posted the picture of the cheese on the bread?
I don't think it was him.
He's one. Anyways, all these photos came out from there.
But the guy who started the fire fraud Twitter account is also in both of them.
Okay. And so there's a tiny, tiny bit of overlap. And beyond just the fun of watching them.
The schadenfreude.
Right. And feeling smug about your decisions in life because you weren't idiotic enough to shell out all this cash to go get sucked into this big sham. They both provide a really interesting, entertaining, and relevant snapshot of where we are now.
Sure.
As far as like too much tech money and the pressure of social media and
these
influencers.
Yeah.
Right. The fact that like everything that this festival was about was essentially for people to have Instagram moments.
And as fun as it is to watch, like, you know, rich 20-somethings suffer in an airport, like, both movies also kind of talk about all the people in the Bahamas who did, like, a lot of, like, grunt labor to try and get these tent cities built and stuff, who then got totally fucked over and not paid.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, yeah, part of it is the sort of schadenfreude of these, like, Instagram kids, you know, going on this stupid adventure. But it's also like, no, there are real people who really suffered because of this. And also the people who worked at Fire, the people who were working on the app.
Right.
And
didn't get paid, got laid off.
Yeah, like one guy talks about how, you know, I guess maybe he was the CFO or something. And so, like, Amex is suing him for all this money that Billy charged on the company card to pay for Magnesa's stuff.
It's fascinating.
The CFO would know that and see that happening and be responsible.
Maybe he's not the CFO.
But he's
the one getting sued, so he's got some tie into all this. Anyway, I think, yeah, you can look at this story as kind of a metaphor for our times. But just as a you know, whether you're like eating popcorn or looking at them more seriously, I think they're both interesting films, and they I think together give you a fuller story.
This makes me wish that Celebrity Deathmatch on MTV was still a thing, because I want to see McFarlane versus Martin Shkreli.
Oh, God.
And then I want to say, who was that New York socialite who was also a total grifter, Anna Selvey? She also was involved with Billy McFarlane somehow. So it's a whole like age of, fake Instagram stuff to create a lifestyle that doesn't really exist.
Boy, you come from a legacy of grifters, the rise of the internet must have just been like, whoa.
So, yeah.
Anyway, so I'm saying 7.2 for both. They're both good. They both have problems potentially, but they're both worth seeing.
I say 7.5 for both. I think they're both really interesting documentaries, and they don't completely take it across the finish line, but I think together they accomplish more than they do separately.
So our numbers are 7.4, and so the Netflix one has a slightly higher tomato meter score, is at 92% versus 87 for the Hulu one. But if you just look up Fire on whatever your Roku is or whatever your search thing is, you will find them both. And they're both pretty zippy. They're both like an hour and a half long, 80 minutes long. They're both like zippy, breezy watches. So
with lots of supermodels in it.
Lots of frolicking in slow motion on the beach, yes.
Nice. But only one of them shows you pigs attacking Bella Hadid, which is a thing that happened. I'm not making this up.
That's the series I would watch.
Yes. So many of you guys asked us to talk about television. When will you do television reviews? Please talk about television.
How about now?
It's good to have you back, but can you please talk about television?
Yes.
And there's so much TV that I have just missed that I won't even begin to like try to go back and watch 6 seasons of Game of Thrones or whatever it is.
Right.
So I give up.
And we've never had Christy at the table with us talking TV before, but now we are. So we're going to talk about, we're looking at season 3 of True Detective, and I know both the first 2 episodes aired, but somebody didn't understand how that works.
I didn't understand the assignment. I only watched episode 1.
We'll talk about episode 1 this week, and next week we'll double up and talk about 2 and 3.
Can we talk about Stranger Things when it comes out later this year?
Yes, absolutely.
Because that I've totally seen every second of.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so on July 4th of this year, Stranger Things.
Maybe, if everybody asks really nicely, maybe Alonzo and I could do something about Star Trek.
I did not watch the first season of Discovery. Somebody else wants to. And if you and Ben want to talk Game of Thrones, I know people are dying for that.
Well,
I've never seen a second.
Like, we're going to get.
I could, I could, like, dip a toe in and pretend that I know what I'm talking about. Like, why is this dragon mad at this other dragon? I'm so confused.
Dragons, y'all.
So, okay. Who wants to describe this first episode of the new season?
All right, so this is season three of True Detective, and of course, these are new stories. Nick Pizzolatto, who created the show, is still writing. These first two, I don't know if the whole season, is directed by Jeremy Saulnier, who did Green Room and Blue Ruin.
He's only directed the first three. Yeah, and actually there was a clash between him and Pizzolatto, and he's not directing anymore.
Three episodes. He's so good, because part of why I like this was it's so moody.
Well, but Pizzolatto is famously very exacting and very persnickety. And
he directed all of season two himself, didn't he?
Yeah, which, you know, he's also... Now, before we get into this, Pizzolatto has kind of... basically apologized for season two because it was rushed, and he's kind of said, like, yeah, you know, we rushed it, we went too fast. And you can tell, I mean, this is 3 years, this season comes 3 years after season two, and he's definitely taken his time. And within, I mean, we're only going to talk about the first episode, but even in the second episode, like, that pause, I think, has made a big difference.
Right.
This feels much closer to what we got out of the first season. I hope that the end pays off in a way that the first season kind of didn't. Mm-hmm. But I'm really digging this so far.
Yeah, no, I'm totally in so far.
Explain, please, Lonzo.
So Mahershala Ali plays Detective Wayne Hayes, and we first meet him as an old man in 2015, and he's clearly having issues with his memory. And so the show... Yeah, I was reminded of Slaughterhouse 5, where Billy Pilgrim is unstuck in time and finds himself sliding back and forth. This detective is kind of unstuck in time because he'll be in 2015. You'll see him in 1990, where there's like a deposition about a case that happened in 1980. So these are sort of the three points of view. In 1980, two young children head off on their bikes and go missing. And the father, played by Scoot McNairy, calls the police. They very quickly find the son's dead body, but the daughter remains missing. And Mahershala Ali's character is a Vietnam vet and spent 2 years in the jungle as kind of a tracker. So he's really good at
long range recon patrol.
Yes,
they call it a LARP. Right, his nickname is Purple.
Purple Haze.
Right. And he talks about how he hunts. You know, he'll use a muzzle loader to hunt the boar. He uses a bow to hunt deer. Like, he goes and hunts, you know, one animal and tracks them. And you see that play out in his investigation. He's very thoughtful, and it's fascinating because he's very meticulous. And so when it starts playing back and forth with his memories, which right off the bat, he's getting interviewed in 1990 for this deposition, going back to the old case. And one of the attorneys says something to him specifically like, you're having memory problems.
Mm-hmm. Already in 1990.
And then, by 2015, he's basically sort of mementoing himself, where he has like a tape recording that he plays for himself every morning to remind himself what's going on. We see him at one point in 1980 talking about how he never plans to marry because he thinks his life is too complicated and he's too difficult. But then he meets and falls for Carmen Ejogo, playing the school teacher of one of the missing children.
Right,
we find out eventually that she writes a sort of like In Cold Blood type book about this case. They have two children together. He is clearly estranged from the daughter. We don't know the full story about that yet, but the son is still around.
Right, and as the old man, we see him participating in a documentary series called True Criminal?
Something like that.
Right.
That's what they're talking to him for in his living room.
Right. They're talking to him in his past. And then we also, you know, he goes back and forth. His partner, Roland.
Yeah, Stephen Dorff.
Is played by Stephen Dorff, who is channeling, who's absolutely like, boy, they really wanted Kiefer Sutherland here. Right?
The hair, look in his eyes.
Right, the look in his eye. Like, he's definitely doing like world-weary Kiefer Sutherland. But they have this really interesting dynamic where you really get the sense that that Mahershala Ali's character, that Wayne is the lead detective. And this comes up more in the second episode, but you already see that Roland is able to, you know, when they first are setting the APB, like, Wayne says something to the rest of the white cops who are, you know, a little slow to like listen to what he's saying. Whereas
it's Arkansas,
right?
We should
mention Arkansas, right? And you know, when Roland is talking to either witnesses or just the other cops, like they're looking at him, mm-hmm. right? You know, when they first get to Scoot McNairy to talk about it,
they kind of plant this stuff. And the woman who does the documentary asks him a question about how she's been studying sort of black men who have,
or she says marginalized people,
right,
working in the system that keeps them marginalized,
like corrupt white power structures, basically. So that's going to come up more. They start planting the seeds of sort of like, as with the first season of True Detective, and I guess to the second one to some extent also, where politics plays a role in all of this, and who are the DAs on the rise, and how are they going to use this case to sort of, you know, feather their own nests or whatever. But this is what people have come to expect from the show, which is it is very deliberate and very moody and atmospheric,
right.
And the performances are understated but intense.
Right, and I think that this is a lot of what everybody was hoping for out of season two.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and there's these quiet moments that, you know, like they're. You could argue that they're obvious, but they're so well executed. Like one of the first conversations that Wayne has with Amelia, where he kind of says, well, how is it? Right. How is it here? Mm-hmm. And there's this, you know, and you get
unspoken.
It's not even really that deep a subtext, but they're definitely talking about like, oh, how is it working with all these white people? And she's like, it's okay. You know, and they do it enough that like, you're not going to miss it, but they execute it so well. And I think so much of it is Ollie is so good in this role. Like he's so good at being laconic. That's the second time I've used this today, but he's so good at being quiet and understated. And yet he's not just a wall. He's not what we're complaining about Bruce Willis does.
Right. Phoning it in
like,
in glass.
He
lets you know there's something under, and you can still kind of tell what it is, even though he's not demonstrative in the way that his partner is.
Well, also he's in the tricky position of having to play a character over several decades, right?
Right. Yeah.
You have to make each version of this man distinct from the others and yet have there be a consistent through line as to his personality, as to what matters to him. And he does that so, I mean, it's not shocking to say Mahershala Ali is like one of our great actors today.
Yeah, but I'm glad
it's so subtle, though, the slight differences over that decade. And it's tantalizing between 1980 and 1990. Like, you can't wait to find out what's going to happen in those years that made him become who he becomes.
But I'm really glad you brought that up because, you know, the obvious one is him as an old man. You can really see the difference there. But I feel like between 1980 and 1990, you see, even though he's not, you see the 1990 Wayne more confident, right? And I think more assured of himself and a little bit
edgier,
right?
Which
like
is
a little
the,
bit more.
Which is the family version.
Right. Which is
the married version.
Right. But it's also like, there's definitely that, but it's also a little of like, he doesn't have time for all that garbage anymore. Where, you know, this 1980 version, like he's still, you know, he's still wrestling with what came after Vietnam. Mm-hmm. He still, you know, he's very, very aware of being the black cop in this white precinct. But I think he portrays that really well. And I think you do get this division. I'm really happy with where the show is going and what we've got so far. And I really enjoyed it.
And one thing to keep in mind is since you've never watched the show before, is that ultimately the reveal of who the criminal is not super important.
Okay.
Like, it matters.
It's more of a character study.
It's really much more of a character
than
study.
Than a whodunit.
About the investigators and what having to stare at this stuff over time does to them.
Yeah. No, he has really lovely chemistry in just a couple of scenes in the first episode with Carmen Eshoogo. Mm-hmm. And she is, of course, just radiant always. And then he and Stephen Dorff have very different chemistry with each other, kind of like a prickly back and forth with each other. It's really enjoyable. But yeah, there's just like this steadily building tension. I really liked a couple of Jeremy Saulnier's films. I really liked Green Room and Blue Ruin. Mm-hmm. He does do like quiet atmosphere, quiet, like steadily building tension very well. There is a chill to this place. There's a desolation, you know, it's middle class, borderline lower middle class. And you feel that in ways that are tactile and real and not like wallowing in Southern poverty for kitsch value.
Sure.
Or, you know,
poverty porn.
Yeah, it's not poverty porn, exactly. So, yeah, I was really impressed. And I kind of wish I had been watching this show all along.
Well, when this season's over. I'm sure they're all on HBO.
They're all there somewhere. And I will watch episode two. We'll do two and three next time. Yes. I promise we will.
You have to go back and watch season one so you can impersonate Matthew McConaughey saying, "Time is a flat circle."
Oh, is that what that's from?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So, television. It's a thing we're going to do.
Yeah. I'm not going to tell you. If you have shows you want to suggest, you're going to do it anyway. But look, we have a lot of movies to watch, so we're doing our best here. But we're gonna totally see out.
There's only three of us.
This season of True Detective, and thank you for everybody who's been, you know, chatting with us on Twitter. We're at BFast all day, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all that stuff. Leave us positive reviews in all the places that you can. We're just getting this thing started. And at some point, we are talking about Patreon.
Yes. Maybe. Bells and whistles.
We got to figure out what that would look like and be, but, you know, it's something we're talking about.
We have ideas. And then next week coming out is The Kid Who Would Be King, which is better than you might think it is.
From the director of Attack the Block.
Yes, and also Serenity. Speaking of Matthew McConaughey. Yeah, so again, it's super January. Oh, also, you guys, on Tuesday, we're going to do an Oscar podcast.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we're going to come in on Tuesday and do a quick response to nominations when they come out and stuff.
Tuesday morning is Oscar nominations, and so we'll post something later that day.
Yeah.
So look for that next. Thanks.
Cool. Bye.